Good morning. Thank you for coming by. It's for once a cool enough day that you could be out hiking and actually enjoying it rather than boiling. So thank you for coming to this. My name is Jody Kretzman. I'm from Chicago. I teach public policy and community development at Northwestern University and direct a center there, kind of action research center, works with communities across the United States and beyond, called the ABCD Institute, Asset-Based Community Development Institute. We have a small group at Northwestern and then an extensive group of 33 adjunct faculty across North America and now a couple dozen more on five other continents as well, who sort of work at this community building stuff from a common framework, a common set of glasses. Let me ask how many people were here. I did something day before yesterday. So I won't spend much time at all going over that, just to say that we are constantly talking with folks in communities about what works, and we are reminded constantly to take this half-full, half-empty glass with us all over the place as a reminder that this glass has a lot to teach us about who we are as individuals and how to think about communities, that we are all, as individuals, partly full and partly empty, and that communities are the same way. And that it matters a whole lot which part of this glass you recognize first and which part of the glass you try working with. That you don't want to necessarily follow the lead of the federal government and think about devastated neighborhoods as only sets of needs, but that you want to also, and probably more importantly, be thinking about them as sets of assets. And so we reviewed a little bit the kinds of assets we think are present in every community, no matter whether it's a wealthy community economically or low-income community. Every community has skilled residents, networks of voluntary relationships, places where people are paid to do the work, nonprofit, private, and public institutions, physical assets, economic assets, and some stories. Another quick way to summarize what we're up to here is we're sort of moving from the right-hand column, which here is labeled a social service model, to the left-hand column. And there's some shifts here. So the inherited way of doing things is a social service model, where we focus on needs most of the time. We ask people what the problems are, and we see if we can address them from the outside. What we're working on is developing, not necessarily ignoring the needs at all. The right-hand column does not get negated. It's still there. But we're trying to shift, I think, the emphasis to thinking about assets. Rather than responding constantly to problems, how do you think about where are the opportunities? Where are the places where you can build? We talked a little bit last time about the shift from charity to investment. How do you think about relationships with struggling communities, not as relationships of charity, but as opportunities for investing in their assets and capacities? If the social service model had as its main emphasis paid agencies or NGOs, who would be then the carriers of problem solving into communities, the emphasis in the community building model, or ABCD, is much more on voluntary associations. Where are the block clubs? Where are the churches? Where are the cultural groups and the youth groups? And how do you get those engaged? The social service model tends to be clinical and therefore focused on individuals. And we're much more interested on the community as the context of individual well-being. Social service model, not surprisingly, wants to deliver services. But I think we're learning more and more in the community building end of things that a healthy community needs fewer services. So that a measure of health in a community is the withdrawal of services, not the adding of them. Right? In the old way of doing things, power always comes from credentials or office holding. Much more in the community, power comes from the relationships and the networks. Who are the natural leaders who know everybody, right? In the social service model, we're always looking for new programs. And I think in the community way of doing things, we're looking for the people, where are the energies, and how then do the programs grow out of those. We have language in the social service model. We'll spend some time on this today. for emptiness. People are clients or recipients. In the community building model, we're interested in people as producers or citizens. So that's the sort of overview. Is that any questions or reactions about that? Does that, we could add another 10 categories, I think, from this to that. Any, does that make sense? Are you?
When does the shift started taking place?
I think it's a constant
last decade,
thing.
Or, has it been more intentional and written down like this in the last decade, 20 years?
We started working on some of these ideas probably late 70s, early 80s, and then people began picking them up and marrying them to a whole bunch of other kinds of things. This is not pure work, right? These are sort of tendencies. They're ways of thinking about what you're doing in a community. So it's I personally rebel against the word model. So I don't really like this because a model sort of implies a cookie cutter thing that is the same all over the place. So I'm much more interested in words like perspective.
Yeah. I think just from a very practical point of view with this the ARRA funds, all the federal funds now that are particularly coming into the domestic economy that are pretty much top down in their orientation. What do you see as a challenge in maintaining this kind of a model in that kind of an economic?
Yeah, it's immense. It's absolutely immense. There are a whole lot of problems. One of them is that we only really know how to do policy from the top down. We have had some attempts in the last 30 years of trying to build policy from the bottom up, take what works in local communities and build it up and say what supports that. There's certainly some receptivity in the current administration for that way of thinking about policy, but it's an uphill battle, One of the reasons it's an uphill battle is because working in the community building way takes time. Relationships take time. All of that is a relationship-driven kind of set of processes. And the urgency of now, as they're talking about in Washington these days, on about 20 different fronts, domestic and international, means that there's not much patience with the relational nature of the community building idea. There is, though, at the same time as that stuff is going on, mobilizing people for particular issues in Washington that are defined from the top down, there is a parallel set of conversations that's still very much alive about how, in the longer term, you begin to get a more grassroots, bottom-up idea happening. So it's just going to take a little bit more time. Yeah?
I realized in your first session that I have no idea what
okay.
Although our president was one.
Yes, right.
Would what he did as a community organizer be more involved in the community building model than social service model?
Yeah. Let me just say, how many people here know something about Alinsky-style community organizing? Is that familiar?
Alinsky.
Okay.
Alinsky. So Saul Alinsky, A-L-I-N-S-K-Y. Is sort of universally recognized as the godfather of modern urban community organizing. Let me do a real quick summary of that. Help me out, those of you who are experienced with it. In the 30s and 40s, in Chicago, Alinsky was at the graduate school at the University of Chicago, was sent out to study basically juvenile delinquency and began seeing the community determinants of crime, how poverty and other kinds of situations in the community led kids astray. And he began thinking about what is it that makes communities strong and healthy. And he got two sources of inspiration. One was from the labor movement. He became a sort of disciple of John L. Lewis and the mine workers. Lewis was probably the most fiery, charismatic labor leader of the 1930s. Right?
Grabbing the news every morning, you know, in the 40s was John Lewis was at.
That's right.
Driving presidents crazy.
That's right. So he learned at Lewis's feet about how unions were organized to come to the table powerfully to be able to bargain with owners and management. Right? That was, and he started saying, now, what if neighborhoods were organized to be able to come to the table, to bargain with the outside forces that shape so many of our neighborhoods? And his other His other source of inspiration was the mafia, which he thought, which was pretty ubiquitous in Chicago in most days, maybe today too. But he thought was the group that understood power in a slightly different way than the labor movement did, but in a way that was worth paying attention to. And then the third group he got into the conversation was the Catholic Church. So he's marrying the labor movement, the Catholic Church, and the mafia. Those are the sources of community organizing. The community organizing idea basically is that every neighborhood, no matter how low income, is already organized. This is how Linsky would say. There are churches there. There are ethnic groups there. There are labor groups there. There are women's groups there. There are youth groups there. But Linsky would say, it's not organized for power. It's not organized for power. So his idea was, can we go into communities using the already existing networks and groups and band them together in what he called people's organizations, or organizations of organizations, get people talking to each other about their common interests and their common agenda, and put something together that was powerful enough to be able to go to City Hall and sit down with the mayor, or go to the banks and sit down with the banks, or go to the Department of Transportation and we've already to build an expressway that cuts through the neighborhood and stop that. So what Barak did in the Developing Communities Project was in that tradition, in the Linsky-style community organizing tradition. There are now four national networks of these mostly congregation-based organizations, although all of them now have other members as well besides congregations. But there's the Industrial Areas Foundation, which is Alinsky's own national network. Mostly on the West Coast, PICO, some of you might probably know, the Pacific Institute for Community Organizing. More in the Midwest, there's the Gamaliel Foundation out of Chicago, and in the Southeast, in Miami, there's a group called DART, the Direct Action Research and Training Group. And all of these are national networks of local groups that train organizers and put them into the field to help direct the organizing process in various cities. How many of you have been involved in church-based community organizing at all?
In what?
In community, church-based community organizing, congregation-based community organizing. Do you want to comment at all on?
Well, like a lot of people here, I've done social service work, and you certainly got the right-hand column, right?
Yeah, okay.
Say to that, and we've tried to bring we have brought the churches together, a number of churches together relative to homeless services.
Yeah. Okay.
Providing a place for women, children, men who are not part of family units to sleep at night when the shelter gets filled. So
yeah. Okay.
Overflow.
So the relationship between what we're doing here and the traditional Linsky organizing, I was trained by Saul Linsky, so I still have an immense amount of respect for that tradition, and that's what Barak was trained at. But when we were doing that kind of organizing, we did a lot of stuff in the social service column. We would tend to really try to find what are the issues or needs and problems that really rub people raw. What are the ones that they get so ticked off about that they're ready to come out into public and go to meetings and so forth. And then often, we would, as the solution, go after increased services or increased programs. The Alinsky style organizing generally is about how do we get a sort of dense pack of community power together to speak to outside groups. And the analysis is, in a lot of our low-income neighborhoods, and I agree with this, the reason they're struggling is because the public sector and the private sector has failed. The economy has failed, and government has failed in many of our low-income neighborhoods. And therefore, the answer is, how do we get government re-engaged in productive ways, and how do we get the private sector to reinvest? So big, big campaigns around ending redlining, the process of banks not investing in communities, and starting greenlining, the process of getting people to invest. But the common thing is the problems out there and the solutions out there. In talking with our Alinsky friends these days, we're pretty clear that that's part of what needs to be done. And the other part, Alinsky people sort of like conflict language, war, you're always after an enemy of some kind. So one of the analogies we say is, you know, you guys are doing great stuff, but you're hopping into the boxing ring with one hand tied behind your back. You're only using one fist. The other fist is, and that's what this column is mostly about, is not how do we get together and make somebody else do something for us, but what can we do for ourselves, right? What have we got here that begins to express our own capacities, our own capabilities to solve problems? So I guess we're interested now in a two-fisted approach, if you will. Where are the situations in which people can take the future into their own hands, and where are the situations in which their power gets expressed by holding somebody else accountable? One of my favorite illustrations, you run into this all the time in communities. Say you've got a rubble-strewn, toxic, vacant lot, right? You've got two choices if you're an organizer. One choice is that you can get 25 or 30 people together and pick up some dead rats and take them down to City Hall and dump them on the mayor's desk, whatever, right? And get the mayor's attention. And remind the mayor.
You can get to the mayor.
Get up there. Remind the mayor that he has a responsibility for his Department of Streets and Sanitation to clean up these lots. That's their responsibility. The other thing you could do is to get the same 25 or 30 people together on a Saturday morning and get the shovels and the wheelbarrows and someplace to, a dumpster to put the stuff and clean it up yourself. Right? I think both of those are fine from my point of view. My own bias is to go the second route. And the reason is, when you've been part of, I mean, you know this at Holden, when you've been part of working together, getting your fingernails dirty, getting your hands dirty in the soil, there's something about that experience that binds you to that piece of land, as well as to the other people. Right? So some of the most moving community moments in my life are times when a community organization does something like that, then gets people to, sounds a little hokey, but get together after they've cleaned this up, hold hands for a minute, sing a song, say a prayer, and then close their eyes and imagine what this place is going to be 10 years from now. Is this affordable housing? Is it a community garden? Is it a playground? What do we need to do with this place? And they're not just imagining. They now know, because we've cleaned it up, this is our place. We can make this happen. So those are two different choices. And I think Barack was, we were in conversation with him when he was organizing, and he was very aware of both of those things. In a sense, and he wrote a piece once about the difference between thinking about neighborhood residents only as consumers of somebody else's goods versus producers of their own future, right? Which is a language that we use as well. So that's community organizing. That's too long an answer. Let me turn to a couple quick examples. The title of this morning's session is The Inclusion Movements. And let me just say a word about what I mean by that. There are two more or less separate phenomena, movements out there that we've been connected with that are incredibly important, I think, and will continue to be more important in the next decades. Both use the word inclusion in defining who they are and what they're up to. One is in Europe, particularly the United Kingdom, but also in a bunch of other European countries, and then in the last decade, Australia as well. There's a whole policy lens in public, in government, that gets labeled social inclusion. People heard that term at all, social inclusion? It's the way in which Europeans, at least some Europeans, talk about social justice, I think. Right? It's how do you think about sort of demarginalizing populations? And it's become increasingly important in Europe as the Europeans have begun facing what we've always faced in the United States. That's what David's been talking about. What do you do with all these immigrants, right? They've never really had to face that any longer. I was in Dublin last year, and Dubliners aren't quite sure what to do with the fact that 85,000 Dubliners are Turks, right? They're used to pretty much all Irish folks looking alike, and all of a sudden they've got these Turks. And the question partly is, And that's all over Europe, obviously. It started with guest workers, but now there are residents all over the place. A lot of Muslim people, France in particular, has had a tough go of it. But the question is, how do you think about these newcomers not as problems, but as resources, as potential contributors to the economy and to the social life of the country? How do you begin to really value the contributions that these new populations can make? So that gets called social inclusion. It gets applied not just to new immigrant populations in Europe, but also to other populations that have been marginalized by economic status or all kinds of other factors in their lives. So that's one set of conversations. It's just now being imported in the United States. The first Washington Conference on Social Inclusion was in April. I spoke at that at the Department of Health and Human Services. And they're beginning to see that there's some resonance with a lot of folks on this idea that justice includes, that you can, people know the work of John Rawls a little bit, that justice can be defined as right relationships, and that inclusion is reconnecting people who have been marginalized and pushed out of those right relationships and bringing them back into right relationships. So that's one whole movement. The other is the movement that is led by, defined by, people with disabilities. Our own experience is that the community of people with disabilities internationally is far ahead of most of the rest of us in thinking about inclusion in really, really creative ways. And I'll spend a little bit more time on that. Particularly, we learned from Canadians. The Canadians are way ahead of us in the United States in this conversation as well. I'm going to come back around to that in a minute. But since the dynamic here is exclusion and inclusion, I thought I'd throw in somewhere near the beginning here a quick concrete example, basically of how in the real world you can see a couple of different ways of thinking about a human being. I want to show you a couple quick surveys. The first is a survey form from a state welfare department. I won't name the state. But you know, all the states have been struggling with this welfare to work mandate. People have to be on a timetable to be able to show that they're either training for work or they're getting work. So in one state, this is what the state tells the welfare worker that she or he needs to know after the initial intake interview, the first 20-minute interview with a person who is starting to make this difficult trek from welfare to work. So here's what we need to know about this person. Tell me about your inadequate housing, your limited job skills, the job-seeking skills you don't have, your poor work history, how often you've been fired from jobs or quit them. If you don't have any recent work history, tell me about your high rate of absenteeism, the GED or high school diploma you don't have, the training you don't have. Well, maybe here's a neutral question, how old you are.
Yeah.
But then we get back to the important stuff. Are you a pregnant or parenting teen, single parent? Do you have any child care? You do have skills, but unfortunately they're not in demand. You lack reliable transportation, no driver's license, you've got sick dependents, you don't have the necessary credentials, it goes on and on. You don't communicate very well, do you? You're uncertain about your employment goals. You do have goals, but they're unrealistic. You don't have the right clothes. You've got family problems. Now tell me about your bad eyes and your bad ears. And your other medical problems. Your friends and family won't be very supportive, will they? How about your history of mental illness, your felony record, how often you've lost your benefits? And then we have it all to say, now that we know everything we need to know, please share any additional information necessary for developing a plan for achieving your training and placement goals. Any reactions? I can see that there are some.
Please tell us the state and we can confirm our suspicions.
The bad news is that we have stacks of these.
That's a real
one. Yeah.
Real.
Yes.
And we didn't make that up.
We have stacks of them.
Is it currently
stacked? What do you mean we have stacks?
It's been revised slightly, but not much.
Oh my God. I've never seen anything like that. I can understand why
why that information could be useful.
Of course, of course.
But it's also very demoralizing.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Concentrating
it's
on all the possibly bad things.
Absolutely.
There's no positive.
Absolutely.
That does follow your medical model, the so-called problem oriented.
That's
and
right.
In fact, you only paid for problems. Mm-hmm. You're trying to help somebody stay well or be well, and you're not paid.
That's right. It is the medical model. And it's all about focusing on the emptiness, which in the medical model is called diagnosis, right?
Yeah.
So that you can move to treatment, right? There's a logic about this. It's very hard to assail, right? If we want to help somebody, we've got to know what's wrong, right? But I think the unintended consequences have to do with, well, lots of different things. But maybe the worst is, you know, if I'm the woman being interviewed, you can just see sinking down into the chair, right?
No wonder I don't have a job.
That's right. That's right.
Failure.
That's right.
Well, you could get the same information with positive. Give me an hour with that, and I could get the same information with a really positive.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You could get a different tone.
Yeah.
To it, absolutely. I think that the truth is, though, if I'm the interviewee, and I'm a 24-year-old single mother of four, this is about the 10th time in my life, if not more, since first grade, that somebody in authority has sat me down and asked me a series of questions that were about the empty part of my glass. Mm-hmm. What have I failed? What can't I learn? What have I, where are my deficiencies in school? How often I've been in trouble? And this doesn't happen just to low-income people. We have other, people know we collect this stuff, right? So they send it to us all the time. You've got a stack of them that are aimed at young people. The minute a young person gets into trouble, she or he is likely to be sat down by somebody in the juvenile justice system who starts asking them, how often have you thought about suicide lately? Tell me about your drug abuse. Tell me about your alcohol abuse. Tell me about your gang affiliation. Tell me how often you were beaten by your parents. Tell me about your background of sexual abuse. Kids get used to that. There are other populations, certainly the population of people with disabilities that we'll talk about in a bit, always getting asked about their disability and their ability. We have some examples now, going back to David's sessions in the last day or two, from the immigration department, where they sit people down and as part of the immigration process, ask them about all of the trouble that they got into back in the home country and all of the things that they ran afoul of the law about. All of the stuff that they couldn't do to support their families. I have noticed, you may notice this as well, some of you, as my hair has grayed, that older adults often get asked a whole bunch of questions about what's broken now that used to work. What can't you do now? My favorite question is, what can't you remember that you used to be able to remember? That's really unfair. I don't know. I can't remember.
And the answer is, I can't remember.
Exactly. Exactly. So there's a whole set of patterns here that I just sort of pointing to, where people in authority with huge institutional resources behind them, and often for the best of motives, are constantly bombarding people who are potentially marginalizable with a reinforcement of their marginal status. Not many people who do this intend marginalization. They intend help, but the unintended consequence of the intention to help is often that people get cut off more severely from connections to community, from right relationships. Does that make sense? The good news from our point of view is that the stacks of examples of that kind of conversation, which still continue to grow, are now dwarfed by stacks of the opposite. People in communities who are inventing different conversations to have at the local level. What would the conversation look like if we wanted to get at the full part of the glass? So I just wanted to show you we've got dozens and dozens and hundreds of these now, but I wanted to show you one of my favorites real quickly. Let me give you the background on this. This is just a one page, although I have it two pages. This is from a soup kitchen in Cincinnati, Ohio. Neighborhood called Over the Rhine, which is by far the toughest neighborhood in Cincinnati, inner city neighborhood. Low-income neighborhood. The biggest African-American church in Cincinnati is called New Prospect Baptist Church. It's pastored by a dear friend of ours, Reverend Damon Lynch. And Damon is a genius community builder. He's made his church into a real center of community energies in Cincinnati. The church, among other things, has long run the largest soup kitchen in Cincinnati. When this particular set of events happened that I want to briefly tell you about, they were feeding 350 people a night, seven nights a week. Right? Big, big operation. They had a few years before gotten a big abandoned industrial building, a one-story building that was probably, I don't know, 10 times bigger than this room, and had taken it over from the soup kitchen. What happened was that all at once, the lay leaders of the soup kitchen, the lead volunteers, the organizers, all at once seemed to hit a wall together. And they had done this for a couple of years. And the wall was basically, you know, we think it's an important ministry to feed people. But it's getting a little frustrating to keep seeing the same people back here all the time. Is there a way we could think about being more effective at making a difference in people's lives? And so they had a whole series of conversations with Reverend Lynch and others about why they weren't. What's the problem here? And their initial conclusion was, well, of course, you can't make a difference in somebody's life if you don't have a relationship with them, if you don't know them. Right? And they said, now, wait a minute. We do know quite a lot about the people we feed in terms of their emptiness. We know that some of them are homeless and some of them are fighting drug and alcohol abuse, and some of them are estranged from their families, and a lot of them are jobless, underemployed. But what we don't know anything about, they said, is their fullness. So let's start a set of conversation, they said, in the soup kitchen, trying to get at people's fullness. And so this is what they came up with. They tested this on each other for months and months. They were very careful about thinking about the language. They wanted to make it as sort of dignified and respectful as possible, and I really love the language of it. Just same amount of time as the welfare interview, 20 minutes, one-on-one, over a cup of coffee. First page of it. What's your name? Did somebody talk to you about what the gift exchange is all about? That's what they called their process here, gift exchange. What do you understand it to be? So they're immediately positing the possibility that the person they're talking to might have an idea, right? And then they put on their own. Basically, we believe that everybody has God-given talents and gifts that can be used to benefit the community. Why are we talking to you? We think you can benefit the community. I want to spend a few minutes talking about your gifts and skills. And then they exchange a brief gift so get that idea going. And then they talk about three categories: gifts, and skills, and dreams, right? Those three things. So here are people who have decided, just like when we were talking about the community, that we learned from community folks that communities could be thought of as a combination of six assets. Here these folks are saying, if you want to know about the full part of the human being, right, there are three things. That if you know about their gifts, and their skills, and their dreams, you know a whole lot about the full part of the class. Maybe there's some other things you want to know, but that's a good start. Gifts are abilities we're born with. We can develop it, but nobody has to teach them to us. So listen to the language. What positive qualities do people say you have? So you don't have to brag. You know, you can say, somebody once said I was a good listener. Just report it. Who are the people in your life that you give to? How do you give to them? When was the last time you shared with somebody else? What was that? They got a lot of answers there about brown paper bags and wine the night before, which was fine. What do you give that makes you feel good? So they're sort of setting a tone in some ways here. And then they go to skills and dreams. Skills. What do you do best? What do you enjoy doing? If you could start a business, what would it be? I like question three. It's the ultimate vocational question that we should all be asking ourselves constantly. What do we like to do that people would pay us to do? ever made anything, ever fixed anything? And then dreams. Before you go, I want to take a minute and hear about your dreams. What are they? If you could snap your fingers and be doing anything, what would it be? And these were not people who had been asked very frequently about what their dreams are. I want to thank you. We're talking to as many people as we can. What we'd like to do is begin a wall of fame here in the soup kitchen, highlighting the gifts, skills, and dreams of as many people as possible. The ultimate goal is to find a way to use those gifts in rebuilding the community. So let me briefly describe what I saw and experienced when I visited the soup kitchen about 6 months after this process had begun. They had been at it for 6 months. When I got there, they had interviewed about 240 people. I had been to the soup kitchen maybe four or five times previously. We'd done a lot of work in that community with Pastor Lynch and his people. And I knew some people in the soup kitchen. But I walked in this time, and it was completely different. I couldn't believe it was the same place. This big old industrial space had been sort of white, gray, cinder block walls, what I'm kind of talking about. But it was no longer that. Now the walls were splashed with eye-popping primary colors. What they had done was selected a bunch of geometric shapes and put big ones, triangles and circles and squares and rectangles, and in each of these big geometric shapes was a person. A person's name, often a blown up photograph of the person or a caricature that's an artist did of the person's face, and then a list of gifts and skills and dreams. So the walls became a celebration of the gifts of the people of the soup kitchen. But the folks who did it were not content with just having a snapshot. They wanted the walls to be a living, breathing tool for community building. So one of the most interesting things they did was clustering. So for example, in the first 240 interviews, they found nearly 40 people who claimed to have some carpentry skills. Somewhere in the back, experience, they'd done some carpentry. What they did was they put a thick brown saw next to everybody who claimed to have carpentry skills. And then they had a thick brown line that squiggled its way around the wall and stopped every time it got to another person with carpentry skills. So they have a little explosion there, right? And what that did was to get all the people who claimed to have carpentry skills connected to all the other people that started introducing themselves to each other. And what I learned was that in the week before, the month before I came to visit, that about 15 of these folks had, in fact, finalized the 501c3 status for a nonprofit carpentry co-op, which had begun to rehabilitate residential and commercial properties in the Over the Rhine neighborhood. Another quick example, in the first 240 interviews, about 75 people identified themselves as having some musical skills, right? Used to sing, play an instrument. And that explained why when I came in about a half hour before supper was beginning to be served, there was on a little bit of a raised platform on one end of the hall, a 15-voice choir that was tuning up. And then for the first half of the dinner hour, the choir ran through its, at that point, probably four or five song repertoire, right? And when the choir finished, up onto the platform came a five-piece jazz combo that had found each other through this process. Right? It wasn't a great jazz combo, but it was spirited. they were still figuring out who each other was. Sort of. So I'm walking through this place, and in another corner there's a children's corner with people who had identified that they'd had some childcare experience and some daycare experience. So there was a sort of children's activity corner with a lot of games going on, some music and some activities. So I'm walking through this place, and slowly in my head, I'm becoming aware that that I don't quite understand what's going on here. So I ended up asking some questions, and this is what I found out. That when people ask about skills, what do you do best? What do you enjoy doing most? One skill got mentioned far more frequently than any other skill. More than half the people, when asked, what do you do best? What do you like to do best? Mentioned this one thing, I love to do X. Got some guesses, I'm sure.
People cooking, tough.
No, people could be, but it wasn't.
Child care.
Could have been child care, but it wasn't.
Gardening.
Gardening, could have been. Tough
people.
Cook. Yep. cooking. I love to cook in a soup kitchen.
Wow.
So after a while, the church folks began thinking, you know, we're learning here something not just about cooking, right? They're telling us something a lot more important than that. What they're really saying is, look, I don't want to be on this side of the table anymore with you on the other side cooking for me and serving me. Because as long as I'm over here and you're over there, you are a fully valued member of this community. And I'm nothing. Right? I want to come around on the cooking side. So the church people, once they sort of understood what the message was here, decided to act on it. They were gutsy people. And they ended up doing two things, both of which were, I think, really smart. The first thing was that they brought the 65 most regular volunteers, people from both New Prospect and a couple of other churches who were the regular volunteers at the soup kitchen, and said, we're really grateful for what you do here. Please keep it up. We want to have you continue to be involved in the soup kitchen. But they said, there's going to be a little bit of a wrinkle, a little bit of a new rule. When you come to volunteer from now on, you come hungry. Don't eat for 5 hours before you come here. Because we're going to become an eating community. Nobody comes here and just cooks and serves. Everybody eats. And they got a little pushback from a few people. So you want us to eat with those people? Yeah. Right? But boy, that had all passed by the time I got there, 6 months into this process. And now what's happening is the people who had been volunteers for a long time at the soup kitchen were bringing their families in once or twice a week. And the whole families will volunteer, and then they came out and ate with folks in the soup kitchen, right? Building relationships across the chasms that were there. Then they thought, okay, that seems to be working with the volunteers. What do we do with the people who are coming in for a meal? And they came to the conclusion, I think rightly, that if they tried to change rules, that these folks had experienced the negativity of rule changing so often in their lives that there really would be some rebellion about that. So they did instead a really smart community organizing thing. They went back over their interview notes and they found the 20 most enthusiastic would-be cooks. The people who just jumped out of their chair, I'd love to cook a mean pot of chili. They went back to those 20 one by one and said, we noticed that you got very excited about telling us about your love of cooking, and it happens that we really need some people in the kitchen to help. Would you join us in the kitchen as part of the cooking team? And we'll give you a little orientation, but then you'll be part of the cooking team. And what the church folks reported to me was that 19 out of the 20 said yes immediately. The other just had a schedule conflict or something. And started showing up almost at once in the kitchen, many of them multiple times per week, right? And then what happened, much quicker than most of the church people expected, was that people who were standing in line, waiting to go get their plate through, get served, began seeing their colleagues back in the kitchen. What's Charlie doing back there? Charlie's part of the cooking team now. Well, could I be part of the cooking team? Or if you got enough people in the kitchen, maybe I could help serve. Or I noticed that this place, if you've got enough people serving and cooking, I notice it gets a little messy. I'd be happy to be part of the cleanup crew or help with dish team. I've got some free time. I don't have a job. I'd be happy to help pick up some of the food that comes in here to the soup kitchen. And that was the explanation for what I had seen. And what I had seen was, I've been in a lot of soup kitchens in my life. I'm looking around. There's 300 plus people in this place. And I'm looking around, and it's the first soup kitchen I've ever been in my life where I can't tell who's who. I don't know who the volunteers are from the church and who's coming in from the street for a meal. Right? And that became for me, the more I thought about it, a powerful microcosmic symbol of what I think a healthy community is. Right? A healthy community has nobody is defined primarily by their emptiness and therefore is a recipient of help or service. Everybody is recognized as having some fullness and something to contribute. So that what the church folks had done, in fact, is recognize that there's almost, this is a little bit ironic, but you've all experienced it, I'll bet, there's almost always a radical power difference between people who serve and people who are served. People who help control the people they're helping. People who serve control the people they're serving. Professionals control clients. So physicians control patients. So what they had worked on, if you would put it this way, except after thinking about it for a while, was reducing that power differential in the relationships. They're trying to see, is it possible, maybe not to eliminate it entirely, but to get people on some kind of the same level. Is it, and what they've done, obviously, is put together a two-way street, where everybody is defined as a giver, and everybody is defined as a receiver. There's nobody who's just one or the other. One of the interesting things that happened on that visit is when I met with some of the leaders of the soup kitchen, they were struggling with the question, you know, we need some new language to talk about what we just did here, or what we're experiencing here. We had language about service and help, and recipients, right? And we understood that that was what we were doing, we were feeding people. But what's this now? And so they were rediscovering the power of ancient, simple language. What do we call each other now? Well, how about friends? Or how about neighbors? Right? Or partners? Right? Ways in which you can begin to think about equitable relationships. It also got me thinking a little bit in terms of its analogy to a healthy community about what I think is the core definition within a small d democracy of citizenship. That a citizen is defined as somebody who comes out of her door every morning recognizing her own giftedness, skills, recognizing that her neighbors have some too, connecting with them, and working at least part of the day to make the public space, the public square, the community better. But that's the work of citizenship. It's not just voting every 2 or 4 years. That's important. But it's doing the work of community building on a daily kind of basis. And that's the sort of set of opportunities that the folks in the church construct for people in the soup kitchen. Let me see if there are any reactions to that. Make sense to you?
What a marvelous thing. It's inspiring. And just plain people who just realized what they needed to do.
That's right.
And how to do it.
That's right.
And they've been trained in community building?
No. That probably would have gotten in the way.
Yeah, it moves.
Yeah.
I'd like to know how they got the church ladies to let go of the kitchen.
Critically important question. You know, I think it helped that the soup kitchen was not in a church. So it wasn't their kitchen, right? In a sense, it was a sort of, we all come together in this public space and work together. In this old industrial building, right? So they sort of build on a kitchen in this bigger site. Because none of the churches had any, had even in Prospect Baptist, which is a huge place, didn't have the space to do 350 people.
It makes me rethink my experience helping at a homeless shelter. It really does.
Yeah.
Because mine would have been from the old model.
Yeah. You know, and it's amazing how many people in situations like that have never been asked about the full part of their class, gifts, skills, dreams, and what a difference it makes when they begin thinking about their own considerable frustrations and possibilities. Yeah.
I have the counter story to this one. I lived in Over the Rhine. And
oh, did you? Okay.
Yes. And I lived right down the street from my first year of graduate school. David,
you know,
and I.
New Prospect as well?
It's right near there. We were right on the hill. And actually, and the church we attended is called First English Lutheran Church.
Yeah, right.
Which is used to be sort of like a jewel of Cincinnati, huge, beautiful. And these are all the things that they were never able to figure out how to do. There's white flight.
Yeah.
So they were left with kind of a skeleton community of maybe 20 or 25 people, very mixed, mostly white. And they, all the things that we've been talking about this week, their sense of themselves is, we're small, we're poor, we have a decayed building, nobody thinks we can, you know, there's nothing we can do here. And the Lutheran churches in the area and the synod would occasionally say, well, if you can do this, this, and this, we'll come in and run a soup kitchen on this day. So then you'd get 100 Cincinnati suburbanites coming in from McMansions, doing the soup kitchen, feeling really happy about themselves, and then going back out to the burbs and saying, now, and then telling the community members, these skeleton crew of 20 saying, well, now you keep this up.
Right.
And so, you know, it was kind of this sense that this small community, based on their own self-identity, as well as what the other Lutheran churches from the outside, the synod and everybody saying, well, you've got to do this, if you just did this,
yeah,
sort of thing.
Yeah,
and absolutely, they're still sort of the same group.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's, unfortunately, Carla, that is probably a more typical story than the one we just
heard
here. Yeah.
Well, the food meets the basic needs to give people the energy and the strength to do, to get on with the rest of their life. These folks need some kind of income. How are they helped to make some money?
Well, that's a great question. Some of the results of this process at the soup kitchen, not for everybody, but for a lot of folks, reconnected them to both economy and community. So some of them joined or rejoined the church, both in New Prospect and other places, or became part of the choir at the church, not just at the soup kitchen. The carpentry co-op led to jobs for some of the people who were engaged in that. A number of people got reconnected to school and training possibilities. So this led the idea that people could be useful and contributors in the context of the soup kitchen led to bridging out into the community in a variety of ways. So part of the additional then task for the volunteers at the soup kitchen was to help that bridging process and to try to think about, now where in the Cincinnati economy, where in the Over the Rhine community and other nearby communities, where can people give their gifts, right, both economically and in community terms? So it led to lots of approaches to your question. Somebody, yes?
Yeah, have you written an account of this event?
Yeah, it's in a couple of our, we've done about the 25 workbooks of that sort of our case, sets of case studies of this, and this one is in a couple of different ones that I can point you to. Yeah.
We have a community building, community meal at my congregation. And we have done some of these things, but the question about the church ladies is apt, and it applies in our case to the person who volunteered for months and then became the head cook, who cannot be dislodged from his position of cook and does not wish to work with volunteers. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that the position of community organizer is just an agonizing one. I mean, it involves bringing people together over and over and over and over again to learn about working together as a team. We don't teach a lot of teamwork in our society.
No, that's right. That's right. That's one of my major critiques of school and of universities, for that matter. It's all about individualization, excellence, et cetera. So
true?
Almost in none of my classes do I do anything individual. It's
Is
all
that true?
Teams.
Because I've got little kids, and it seems like they hardly ever do anything by themselves.
Okay, great. Maybe it's changing.
And there's the rub, because mm-hmm. you've got little kids with emotions that don't know how to work it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Pick a few more questions. Yeah.
We have a people's kitchen in San Luis Obispo, and the food is brought by different members of church, amongst other feeding programs. This one is a day center. And some of the clients, some of the people, homeless, maybe occasionally hungry college student or whatever, will show up. One of the interesting things for me at one time while I was helping to serve was then to go eat with people and to ask just kind of basic questions. Your name, where you're from, why are you in San Luis Obispo? Not threatening kinds of questions. The interesting thing is, you know, all of them are people. They're all
That's right.
people. They're not clients. They're not homeless
That's right.
people. They're,
That's right.
they're people. And they all have a story.
Each one has a unique story.
Everyone has a story.
Absolutely.
I'm not suggesting it leads into this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But
absolutely. It's a starting point. Let's get a relationship going. Yeah.
Now, this is a really big project, and it seems to be, it may become an enterprise if you think, you know, make it bigger. How is it organized? You're talking about a community organizer, but I suspect that it will, as it grows, a hierarchy even, or more people to organize it? And how is that organized? And how is the relationship between the ones that organize it and the ones that are carrying it out? And who does the potential conflict management? I suspect many people get on a, your story sounds like, and they live happily ever after. But this is not the way it stays. It grows and grows and grows. So all the project, the problems of every community will probably reoccur there too. So how's that handled? Is it even far enough into it yet so that you can comment on this?
You're talking about the soup kitchen in particular, this
particular
story? This particular
project you were just inspiring us all with.
Obviously, there are huge boulders in the road going forward in these kinds of things. The story I just told you was probably a decade old.
Is it still alive?
And it is still alive. I think it's the leadership has transitioned. I think the leadership provided the sort of backdoor mentorship of Pastor Lynch was really important. He was trained as a community organizer, and community organizers are never up in front. They're always in the back, kind of thinking with the leadership about what the leadership ought to do next. Paying attention to the kinds of questions you're asking. Where is the next generation of leaders coming from? In this case, they were very interested in moving people, some people, into the volunteer leadership of the soup kitchen who had been recipients, had been people coming in for meals. That was a transition that they were really interested in. And that was rocky, but I think they had some success in doing that. They were challenged to get more churches. I don't know if they went after First English or not, Carla, but they got more churches involved in doing the soup kitchen. I think they began working at some of the job creation and economic development challenges in the community. They got buffeted about frequently by events beyond their control. So Cincinnati in the last 10 years has had a series of really tough police community battles. Mm-hmm. Cops have killed some kids and so on, right? And every time something like that happens, a lot of the forward momentum of something like the community building project around the soup kitchen gets backburned while everybody has to deal with the immediate crisis. So you're absolutely right. This is not a fairy tale with
it. Well, part of our question was who runs it? I mean, how does it help? You know, because typically there's a spark plug or a leader or somebody who makes it all work, connects it all together.
I think Reverend Lynch had selected a group of a half a dozen or so lay leaders from his congregation that really did, at least at this time, work together as a wonderful leadership team. And, you know, I think that's transitioned in lots of ways.
And they're all on a non-paid.
They were at that point. I think they now probably have a couple of paid staff, right?
Okay, then yeah. that changes sometimes.
Absolutely.
A lot. You get, all of a sudden you have a paid.
That's right.
Makes you appreciate all the village.
Yeah.
Well, then you have the same thing here too.
That's right.
Saying.
Some
yeah.
people pay here too,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Yes.
What I think is so wonderful about this example is that it clearly pointed out that these people were missing self-confidence and self-respect. And it made me think about my own family and how we can start this process with our kids. Mm-hmm. And how many of us ask our kids these questions
yeah.
that community can ripple out from our homes.
Yeah. Or you could say about the people coming into the soup kitchen that they really did have one major need, and their need was to be needed, to be valued by the community, to be somehow contributors to the community. And once you get that going, you can begin to address a lot of the other stuff in people's lives, I think.
That's on both sides of the fence.
That's right.
So people, suburbanites coming in to do the volunteer work because, I mean, what are they there for?
Right.
What's their need? I mean,
yeah. They absolutely need to be needed. Then I think then one has to ask the question I think that was implied. I mean, one of the first rules, I think, of community work is, from the medical field, do no harm. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a sense in which a lot of the outside-in stuff leaves behind more harm than good in some ways. Another comment or two, Ann.
There's a lot of lessons of empowerment here, which are exciting. And I work in the nonprofit sector, and we talk a lot about sustainability and infrastructure. I think that's what people were getting at here, because when you get these phenomenal successes, how do you make sure that they're continued and that it doesn't follow the charismatic leader, you know, and then they make a change and it all unravels? That, and how can you kind of get the community to own it? And so I think that that's where the real challenge is here, is how do you capture that magic and then make sure that you can sustain it?
That's right. That's right. I mean, the sort of organizational, institutional umbrella of New Prospect Baptist Church in this case, which has a good chunk of the active part of the community in its membership, was the ownership vehicle, if you will, mm-hmm. right? It was the vehicle that could think about sustainability in an institutional kind of a sense.
Because that's how you strengthen a community.
That's right.
You know, and not just have a, you know, this one-time successful, even if it runs for 10 years successfully, it's how does it keep building?
That's
how
right.
You replicate it in another community. And so.
Absolutely. Well, look, this is tough work. There are a lot of obstacles along the way. I think what we've become convinced of is that the bottom line here is that this is a way of thinking about working in community contexts, which at least gives people some realistic reasons to hope. And I don't think people act, I mean, it's not an accident that Barack called his policy book The Audacity of Hope. That's one of the basic ingredients for people who have been taught hopelessness in turning around their lives. So the way we tend to work is find success and spread it. That's the, acknowledging the tough stuff along the way. One last comment, yeah.
I wonder what asset-based community organizing has to say to the health crisis in this country, the health delivery crisis.
Let me just say a word about that. Our entry into the healthcare discussion is to say that we don't have a discussion in the United States of health. We have a discussion of medicine and treatment, right? And that there's a huge difference. That all of the research about what determines whether or not we are healthy people over our lifespan has very little to do with access to doctors and hospitals and clinics. Has everything to do with stuff that only communities can produce, right? Healthy behavior, peer support, economic status, environmental factors, right? Those are the four major elements that determine people's health, genetics and biology aside, right? Those don't come from the AMA, and they don't come from health insurance companies. So I think our entry into this discussion is to remind people that we don't have a national conversation about health. We have a national conversation about sickness, mm-hmm. and that's okay. You know, we could have that, but it's not the same thing.
Have you read the book Outliers?
I've heard about that. Yes, okay.
The first segment is a story. It sounds legendary, but apparently it's real. About a town in Pennsylvania called Rosito, which had a higher level of health than the average Americans. And so they brought researchers in to find out why. And ultimately, the only thing the researchers could point to was that it was a socially healthy community.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We sometimes, if I was doing a different kind of lecture, I would probably start with something like this. This is what the research says about health, that it's a function of, again, genetics and biology side, function of personal behavior, social relationships, physical environment, economic. And it looks like the least important is the fifth one, access to medical care. The other four are the most important. And the other four clearly are affected by most community dynamics, but obviously larger policy contexts as well. But people can do something about the other four without being doctors.
I just recently read in the papers that they checked on American and Canadian cities, as according to these categories, and obviously it's Tucson, Arizona that has the best rate, so I should go under there.
That's interesting. Yeah. Tucson has a very, very strong neighborhood.
And then Toronto, Vancouver, they're very high up too, but Tucson, Arizona. That's the place.
Okay, it's lunchtime. Thank you all.